This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you very much, and welcome for coming. Thank you. What I'm basically going to just have a short chat about the arcade. In retrospect, the laws in New York City, as everyone knows, until Roger was on the scene, there was no pinball from 42 until 76. 41 until 76. My dad, Dave, was a manager of an arcade in Newark. That's where I first encountered pinball when I was about 5 or 6 years old. I used to go there on Sundays with him and, stand on a pinball machine and started playing as a young kid and pretty much got hooked like everyone else. And we fast forward. In 1960, my dad had the opportunity to buy part of an arcade in New York City, which was the Broadway Arcade. It was located at 52nd and Broadway. And that's a picture of our prize counter, since we basically had no pinball machines and obviously no video because that wasn't invented yet. Basically, it was an 8,000-square-foot location on the corner of 52nd and Broadway. Lindy's restaurant was on one corner. Gallagher's famous steakhouse was up the block. It was quite an interesting place. At the Ed Sullivan Theater, before it became the Dave Letterman Theater, was a block away, and it was pretty much as considered at the time the outskirts of Times Square.
But the heart of the theater district.
Right. Yeah, we were in the heart of the theater. Right. Basically, the arcade consisted of redemption equipment. We had, onto the left of that shot, were 20 skee ball machines. To the right were 20, 25 bingarino and pokerino tables. We gave out coupons, and the rest of the arcade was populated by the mechanical devices of the era, dating back to the 40s. This arcade actually was in existence, operating since 1929. I found all this history out because one of my customers, who I'll talk about a little later, filled me in because he was in that area at the time, and he was a participant in different activities, and that I'll get to a little later. Maybe hit the next slide. That, unfortunately, is a little blurry, but the gentleman on the left is my father. I mean, he's passed away, but he really brought me into this world and gave me an ability to have a livelihood that was extraordinary. The location itself sort of, went along for I was 14, 15 years old when I started working on weekends and all my summers. Went off to college, graduated college in 1970, and then went into the arcade full time and basically was working at nights. And that brings us, I don't know what else we see. In the arcade, actually, at the time, being so large, we had subtenants. This is a gentleman, his name is Artie. He ran a magic shop. Actually, the magic shop was very famous. It was run by the Tannen brothers, who at the time are well-known magicians and written books and stuff. So we had that sort of aspect of it. And the other aspect of it, in the front, we also owned a candy and nut shop.
The best nuts in New York City.
And my dad had the bags where we sold the nuts, and they said the hottest nuts in town. I always thought that was kind of funny. But you can take a look at some of the prices on there, and they're pretty extraordinary, 40 cents per pound for a bag of peanuts or stuff. This was probably 1968-69. Another interesting part about that is that a photo artist named, I think Bill Estes, took a shot of that and then did a painting of it, which is in the Whitney Museum. And I never knew that.
Richard Estes.
Yeah, Richard Estes, right. Okay, Richard Estes. And I never knew that until one day I was going through the Whitney Museum and they had postcards of it. And it really knocked my socks off. I mean, so we bought up hundreds of them, and they were about and around. So if you somehow go through his work, you'll see that, which I always thought was very cool. Next slide. This is now moving forward, because you can see some pinball machines there, to about 1977. And to the point where I meet Roger Sharp. Roger was doing his book. Unbeknownst to me, had come into the arcade, had done some research there, took some pictures there, and no clue that he was about and what he was doing. But in the arcade, once we got into pinball, we basically ran about 50 pinball machines and then assorted the same other type of games. Video just started coming in, 76, I guess, 75. So we had this huge influx of new equipment. And what happened was that eventually the skee-ball machines went away and the Pokerino went away, and we just filled the store with the new technology, so to speak. Is there another slide of that? Anything? This is, again, just one of someone who knew me when I was a kid. His name is Joe Sullivan, just one of the great people that worked for us at the time. You can see all the different prizes, and I mean, you know, you talk about redemption today. We would do our shopping at for all these great things at all different types of wholesalers and things. I mean, the plush animals and all the stuff you know is redemption if you see it didn't exist in those days. So we basically had all like dishware and all such incredible stuff. Again, that is I'm trying to think what that is.
Candy counter.
Yep, it's part of the candy counter.
The popcorn machine.
And the popcorn machine, and probably we also, and posters. Eventually we got into the poster business, as well as on the other part, you have to fill up 8,000 square feet, so it becomes, whatever you can do. My dad always taught me that you want to take your space, and you're paying rent 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and you want to maximize the possibilities. So we always diversified into many different areas, just to attract whatever was coming by our door. And the poster business in the late 60s and 70s was probably the hottest thing going on. Okay. And now we've moved on to the now we've gone a little too far, so we'll stop here. This is actually a shot of the newer arcade. When I say the newer arcade, New York City landlords tend to be a little strange. We unfortunately never had the opportunity to buy the building we were in. It was a six-story building that was topped off in 1928 during the Depression, before the Depression, because they ran out of money. And basically, the air rights were sold to the space, and they built a hotel right on top of us from 1981 till 1985, a four-year process where we had scaffolding all around us, and construction. Physically built a 30-story hotel on top of the six stories that were there, because the structure was originally built for 40 stories back in the 20s, and so they had all the infrastructure to do this.
1 second. For those who are ever in New York, and I travel there on business, the hotel is the Novotel. And it's one of the few hotels in Midtown Manhattan where you have to take an elevator up to the lobby. So to Steve's point, you're taking an elevator basically six or seven flights to get to the part where the hotel is actually based, and then 20-some-odd stories above that.
And now, sort of just to give you the history of Roger, now we go back to 1975, 76. I was working nights, and every day or every other day, I see this heavily bearded gentleman come into the arcade, schlepping, as we called it, a big bag, and playing pinball. And as it was for me, I the type of personality I had, I engaged my customers. I was there. I had a change apron on. That's what I did. I walked around, and I made sure everyone was having a good time, and it was a safe environment. So after a couple of weeks go by, and I see the same guy coming in day after day, I come over and say hi. And that's where we met, 37 years ago, probably.
1975, so we're looking at 74, 75 time frame.
Yeah.
So however many years that is, 35,
36
years.
A long marriage, if you might say.
And for those who know us well, they know that it's an interesting marriage, to say the least.
Very. But it was interesting at that point because I really hadn't been involved with pinball. I had played as a kid, and then you know, all the years went by, 10, 12 years, where pinball wasn't even part of my being. And when it started coming in, I picked it up again. And then when we started playing, Roger and I just formed a friendship, a real bond. It was incredible that, you know, happened in a very short time. Sometimes it takes a while for people to get, you know, comfortable with each other, but for some reason, we kind of fell into each other very quickly.
I think it's because on my way to and from work, I'd stop in the morning, I'd come over by lunch, and then I'd come after work to play. So the amount of time that I was spending there was probably almost equal to the amount of time that Steve was working.
So that pretty much ends the sort of old history of Broadway Arcade, in a sense, and we'll start on the new era. So if there's any questions about the, you know, anything about the old place, if anyone remembers it, I still get people come up to me and tell me they were there in the 40s and the 30s, and, you know, it's just, it's very, very rewarding to know that, you know, there's something that was, unfortunately not now, but had was that affected a lot of people's lives. So now we'll fast forward. Now we're now in 1977. I'm sorry.
Let's try a picture. All right, yeah. Gary.
You have anything else?
Okay, right. We've got these right. Two photos.
Yeah, that's fine. We can leave that up there. There's a young me. The gentleman sitting there is named John Hammond, Sr. John, I met John at the arcade playing pinball. John is the son of grandson of Commodore Vanderbilt. He is responsible for discovering musical artists, jazz artists in the 30s. This is the gentleman that gave me the history of what the arcade was. Happened to be in the Congress Ballroom, if anyone's familiar with that, which was on the corner of 51st Street, listening to Lady Blue.
Billie Holiday.
Billie Holiday.
He discovered one of the people that he discovered.
He discovered Billie Holiday. And his career spanned up to Bruce Springsteen, where he discovered Bruce Springsteen, signed Bruce Springsteen to his first contract for CBS Records. And his office was in the CBS building, which they call Black Rock, which was two blocks east of the arcade. So I'd go over occasionally to check in on him, or he, you know, when he didn't come into the arcade every day, his secretary would always call looking for him because he'd sneak out to play pinball. And by the way, his favorite game was Playboy, the original Bally Playboy. John, very interesting in that he, and this is all pinball related, but he would tell me the story about how he met Bruce Springsteen, and they got to trust each other because at the time he said, you know, Springsteen was very cautious and very sort of not paranoid, but he was very worried about his career and what it represented. And they formed the bond because both of them are pinball players. And that's how they honestly got to trust each other, and he signed the contract. I think that's the end of those. Okay, we have some video of the Papa tournaments, but that's really moving a little too quickly.
We'll do that.
Yeah,
I think that.
That slide that's about the size of a postage stamp mm-hmm. is the flyer for planets, and I think Roger's going to tell us the significance of that.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Steve kind of touched upon it, and we're going to get to the heart of leagues and promoting and all the rest of it for pinball. Talk about the new IFPA, talk about really the creation and the start for Papa. And it's interesting because from what Steve was saying, I moved to New York around 1971, 72. And by then, I was already somewhat afflicted, enjoying pinball. And there were a number of playlands in Midtown Manhattan. When I first moved east, I was living in New Jersey, commuting. And, I mean, I've told the story before. I'm not going to belabor it. But among all the various playlands and whatever else, the only place that had a pinball-style game was a Broadway arcade. So the frequency that I was coming back in was to play. There were two games. There were Planets and Zodiac. Williams and Bally, or Williams and Gottlieb, I'm sorry. In 1972, I guess I'd call it the amendment. The amendment that was made when they tried to get pinball legalized the first time, unsuccessfully, was that they were allowed to come in with these machines. And if you go to Internet Pinball Database or anything else, if you're not familiar with them, what you'll see is that there's no plunger. So think of the baseball games. You're popping it over here on the front rail, There's no jet bumpers. There's flippers, so I'm popping it up. There was a row of targets, and not really drop targets, but again, it's almost like a novelty game. And there was a spinner, kind of thing that Pat Lawler used on Safecracker, and we've seen it in other games. That was my, I'll call it my pinball light experience. And as I said, the only location in Midtown, and there were seven different areas of playlands. There's Hubert's Wax Museum with live ammunition downstairs, a shooting gallery, strange stuff around Times Square. So that's when I started frequenting the arcade. At the same time, and we'll now fast forward a few years, obviously getting involved in New York, the court case and whatever else, suddenly pinball is back. I was thinking about it actually the other day when Steve traveled into town, and I remember one of the first games, I'll give you a sense of the era. One of the first games that I remember playing at the Broadway Arcade was a Bally Firecracker. So you weren't talking about new equipment back then that was coming in 1976. You were talking about whatever was, you know, available and around. Let's populate the arcade. There were only a few games to start with, maybe three or four machines, but it was like it was pinball. Okay, I am here. I'm going to play. And the unique environment, and what Steve didn't mention, was the downstairs level was a pool hall, basically pool tables. I mean, so you're looking at like 16,000 square feet of space in this corner edifice. I said before, and I will say it again, the hot nuts were incredible, so you'd go in for nuts and go in to play games. And, yeah, I mean, the frequency of it was I didn't have my first game yet. I started becoming a regular. And here was this person that was very nice, you know, give you change, see them often enough. Suddenly it's like, hi, how are you? It starts getting a little bit more pinball friendly, if you will, in terms of New York. Some of the other locations now have, you know, their own pinball machines. But there was a special environment that Steve really brought to bear. And you would see guys with their briefcases and suits at the end of the workday, not during my other times. Who would come in and play before they were going to Port Authority or Grand Central Station or God only knows where to commute home. And it really became kind of like this small oasis. If you think about it, truthfully, for those who've been in New York City or live in a large city, I mean, you're not talking about very much of a small town mentality. You know, it's all strangers. It's people that, you know, you don't want to look anybody in the eye because somebody's going to stop you and say, hey, I need some change, or I lost my wallet, or God only knows what. And in New York City, and I'm a Midwesterner, so you tend to look at people in the eye until you start getting hit on too often, and then people start saying, you know, somebody's going to pull out a knife or do some other strange things. And it's like, okay, you know, I was very protective of my own well-being. And I really felt that sense of family, if you will, going into the arcade, and you'd see some people who are regulars, high, and, you know, different walks of life. I didn't realize, and over the years, and I'm sure we'll touch upon it, the amount, the amalgam of people that existed in that world. I mean, when you see somebody like Paul Simon coming in and asking for a stool so that his son can play pinball, you see Muhammad Ali coming in, you see Roberta Flack coming in, you see Lou Reed coming in, and nobody's bothering anybody. You know, Sarah Jessica Parker was a nice 12-year-old girl who had just taken over the lead, and Annie was a regular. You would see all the Broadway people because all the shows, I said it before, all the shows were around there. So after breaks, after matinees or whatever else, they're hanging out like regular people, and the arcade was a place where they could go and know that they were going to be safe, and nobody was going to bother them saying, hi, I want an autograph or this, that, or whatever else. So the friendship grew, excuse me, as did, you know, the amount of new equipment that Steve got. At the time, and this is 1975, 76, I started doing game reviews for Playmeter, and Playmeter is a trade magazine. And Critics Corner, which my sons have now taken over, Josh being one of them here, Zachary at home, hopefully asleep. I used to travel down to the New Jersey Shore to play a new game. Now, from New York City, the idea of traveling for 6 hours to play a game for 2 hours, to take notes and whatever else, traveling up to Rhode Island, I mean, going to bizarre, strange places because there was a test game from Playmatic. Bally had a machine, and nobody was doing testing in New York City. So everything that I had to do had to be outside the city limits, or if I could, I'd get to a distributor. Again, not in New York City on 10th Avenue. I'd be going out to Long Island. I'd be going down to New Jersey for Runyon Sales, Mondial, and others for the Gottlieb games, the New Bally games, the New Williams games. There was an influx, if you really can appreciate, back in that time frame of 77 to 79 of the Interflips, Inder games, Playmatics, Segasa. I mean, it was an outpouring of stuff. I have a new friend. He has an arcade. Yes, and so yes. What do?
He set me up.
I said, Steve, because I knew all the manufacturers. I was traveling back and forth. For those who know some of my history, you know, Sharpshooter was in process and whatever else. And it was like, there's this great arcade, guys, that you should be testing in New York City. And I wound up setting up Steve. I had him come out for his first trade show in 1975, 76, which was at the Conrad Hilton in Chicago. It was the MOA back then, the Music Operators Association, to meet people and for people to meet him so that I could introduce this person as being, this is a great guy, you know, he has great clientele, he will get you all of the earnings reports and everything else that you'll ever want and need. And suddenly Steve was part of that inner circle to get the equipment.
I must stop you for a second because it wasn't as easy as Roger just said. It was kind of a setup. What I didn't say was my dad's partner was a gentleman named Al Simon. He was a cousin of my father's, actually, and he was in the amusement business. He was probably the largest distributor on the whole East Coast. And Al was a Williams distributor. So most of our games were Williams games. And because that's, you know, you're not going to sell into your own business other games. But unbeknownst to me, you know, Roger said, you know, this is a good idea. Let's, you know, maybe you should forward it. So I trundle off, this young 20-something kid, to Al's office, and I sit down with Al. And Al was a very domineering character. He built his business in a pretty ruthless way, actually.
There's historical stuff.
Historical
I won't interrupt,
really,
about Al Simon, the power that he wielded back in the 1930s and 40s, truthfully. There were three main people that really controlled the coin-operated amusement game industry back then on the East Coast, and Al Simon was one of them.
So here I go off to my business partner to ask him to pay for, or have us pay for the sort of competitors' games. And for some strange reason, he saw my enthusiasm and my love of what I was doing. And, you know, and I said to him, it makes more sense if we have a variety of different types of games. And he actually agreed with me. So I bit that and passed that. That got by somehow. And people were amazed that it happened because, you know, what are you doing with Gottlieb, Bally games in your store? You know,
and he's making it sound easier. Truthfully, Steve grew a pair. Seriously. And I don't say that with any malice or anything else. I think what wound up happening for the first time, and it was a different mentality than what Dave, Steve's father, had. I mean, you're running your business the way that you've been running it. And if there's new equipment, you just incorporate that new equipment. I think from the perspective of Steve was now a contemporary. And I think that he saw where the future was in terms of equipment in general, the fact that video games are now coming on the scene. You know what? We have to expand, otherwise we're going to die. And I think that it was really bold of him, and yes, it was a setup, absolutely. I knew that it would be. But for him to be able to go in and make it happen. And I give Steve a lot of credit for that because, truthfully, on some levels, it really kind of changed fundamentally what the relationship was going to be, and I'll now move forward. Our days were spent in such a way where Steve was open under ungodly hours. He'd be there incredibly early in the morning, and he'd stay incredibly late at night. I would be done with work. I wasn't married then. The boys weren't born. So it was not unreasonable for me to come by. Maybe I'd go home. And I lived in New York, just outside the village, and you know, take a subway back uptown. Or some cases, since I was strange and actually had a car in the city, I would drive it up and park it in a lot. Get maybe to the arcade by about 8. Steve is shutting down by about 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm still there playing. And for those who have ever played in any IFPA or PAPA tournaments, what wound up emerging from what we did is really the start of all of that, which was, okay, let me start playing this game. All right, you're still counting? Steve, I know, has miscounted. I think at one time, at the height, he probably had about 80 pinball machines. I just remember the various lines and rows of games. I mean, it was incredible. Meticulously maintained. Jaffe was just an amazing guy. And Steve's whole thing for all the equipment was he would start. It's kind of like washing the windows on a land on a skyscraper. Just when you're done at the 1,000th floor, you start again because it's another year that's gone by. And Jaffe would start, you know, every day, wherever he left off, pick up, keep on going. And what wound up happening was I think I got to a wall once. I had already played one ball on 8 games when Steve had come out. And it's like, all right, you're up over there. When you're done, then I'll come. And we started playing walls. And I think that that really became the essence of things because you wind up changing it off. During the day, one of the remarkable talents, and if somebody had a change purse we could show you, is that Steve could get a... Now, he's playing a pinball machine, right? Ball is cradled. He gets a $5 bill. He's reaching into his pouch, and he's getting the guy the exact number of quarters while he's cradling the ball, and then he's going back and playing. So whatever our playing was during those times of business hours in the morning or in the afternoon, and I know Coy knows a lot of this because he goes back to those times, we would just play one game at a time. It was only in the nights or the weekends if things were slower. Let's play a small wall. Let's just do these 6 games in this line. And then it got to some levels of absurdity where we would play 20 or 30 games at a time. And the point I wanted to make, okay, and then I'm going to let Steve jump in,
is
one of the big things by that time was who was the better player. And it was like, well, Steve gets more highs, but I'm more consistent. Now, around that time is really a seminal event for competitive pinball. 1978, I get involved with Bally Super Shooter. My book is one of the prizes. I'm brought in by Bally to kind of help coordinate and bring it all together. Games Magazine, I did a feature for on the tournament and whatever else. And I came out to Chicago and was actually the co-host, and I don't know how many of you are from Chicago, and I won't ask for a show of hands, but there's a radio personality by the name of Gary Meyer. And Gary Meyer used to be with Steve Dahl. They were the hottest thing going about back in the 70s, and his career was just starting. And I was the co-host doing the play-by-play, if you will, of the Bally tournament. There were 1 million people who entered. It was in the Aladdin's Castles back then, which is really miraculous. It was the top 20 players from around the country, ages of 11 to 32. All right, so the Joshua Hendersons of the world are not really anomalies so much as it was back then. One woman, and the finals were staged at the Playboy Towers, downtown Chicago. They had a ballroom that was an incredible setup. It was a lit floor from underneath. And there was like a viewing area, gallery area, and I think I mentioned it to Gary before. This was an event covered live. There was network TV. This is not ESPN or anything else. There was ABC Network News, NBC, and whatever else. The sole premise, and you have to appreciate the mentality of the coin-op industry, and for those who listened to Gary yesterday, there's always an ulterior motive and a purpose as to whatever one wants to do, whether we're talking pro, classic, or anything else for games, and so on, and who counts and who doesn't count for his marketplace. The sole purpose for staging the tournament was that Bally was in the process of getting ready to unveil Playboy. That was the culminating event during that weekend. But the bigger issue was the setup of the games. Walter Payton was there, Gilda Radner, Bill Murray, a whole host of celebrities and everything else. And I helped set up what the games were. It was blackjack. It was games from that era, so 1978, whatever the new Bally games were. I think Power Play was one of them, and I know that's on the floor. And the setup was such that it was based on raw score. And the culminating game was the unveiling of 8-Ball. And the names that I will give you are truly important because it goes back to Steve and I, and I'm going to bring up a case history as to how everything kind of started from that point. It came down to the final 4 players playing on 8-Ball. There was a guy who had been incredible for the entire weekend, and we're not talking about marathons the way that IFPA does it or anything else. I mean, it was It's a few, you know, it's like 5 hours, not 40 hours. I mean, I've been up since 5 o'clock this morning because of the insanity of playing in a pin brawl or whatever it was. But Joe Grillo had been just an amazing player. Skill on all of the games and everything else, consistent, top qualifier for the four. And it was a 2-out-of-3 match on 8-ball was the finals. And Joe Grillo won the first two games, just handily. Ken Lunsford, out of Plains, Georgia, and that's the time of Jimmy Carter, who was president, came back, actually got the 5X on 8-ball, won the last game, and won just by enough in terms of points where he was a champion. When I came back, and again, by then, Steve and I were really close. And, you know, forgetting about who's better, who's worse, it's like, something's not right. You know, this guy won two games. I mean, he won everything throughout the entire weekend. He won 2 out of 3 games, but he lost the tournament. There has to be some way to create, like, a handicapping system. There has to be some type of a scoring system. There has to be some something. On top of that, from a standpoint of vanity and ego, which we both have, it was a question of maybe there's somebody to determine who really is the best. Sir, did you want to take over from there?
Yes. So it was 1979.
Or do you want to do Joe Schick first, which also...
No,
well, okay.
No, we at the time, we were not keeping track of our playing. And
right.
At that point, when Roger came back, he says, I think we need to keep track of our scores. I want to track it. I want to see what we can develop. As it turns out, there happened to be another person that was kind of in our little world. The name was Lionel Martinez, who was a filmmaker. He was also being hanging out at the arcade. And we sort of grabbed him to be our third person.
I needed more than just the two of us.
Two of us.
I wanted four. I forget the guy who was in advertising, couldn't make the commitment.
Oh, Jim Boyke, right?
Thank you, yes.
Right, okay.
So I decided, I mean, I can deal with three.
Right.
And if Lionel will come often enough and we'll just play whatever the games are, I'll keep track of the scores. And Josh knows this. I mean, there is in my house 5 years worth of scorekeeping done by hand.
10,000 games we played.
All tracked.
All tracked.
I could work out the math because I was a lunatic pre-computers and all the rest of it to kind of noodle at it, come up with a scoring system, come up with something that I affectionately called PEBGA, which was a point efficiency per game average. So if Steve was at a 6.4 and I was at a 6.2, all right, how do I factor that in if we're playing games? Because the games all score differently. I mean, I knew that. So how can I equalize it? So if there's another competition, somebody who is here versus somebody who is here, how do I balance that so it's a level playing field? That was the whole purpose for it. That was the starting point.
And this is still, again, at the old arcade, and by 1983, we pretty much felt very confident that we had a system of points that would...
The college guys that did the documentary came in. That was the first, and Josh has seen the video of the guy in my apartment in New York. All right, so there was these college guys doing, in quotes, a school thing or whatever for New York Film School. I roped them in. I don't think that Lionel was there. I was like, all right, it's four players. We're going to do a team thing. Let's see. And in the original scoring system was 10-5-1. For the team stuff, came up with 7-5-3-1, realizing, all right, if I can get a set, so I can then tie. I mean, I wanted something where if it was a three-game series, that third game still meant something. So we roped these guys in. It was a Sunday. They were willing to take the time, and I think it was payback for the fact that I allowed them into my apartment to do this school project. And I forget how many games we played with meat keeping score out of all the games so I could see, all right, the 7-5-3-1 work. You know, if one of them won one game, one of them won another game, all right, what was the point differential? I mean, it was on and on and on because everything was based on raw points.
We wanted to create a system that would equalize, one, the different scoring potentials of every game and the luck factor in every game. So what we did was we basically weighted our system to reward consistency, and that's how it really developed. So because we both agreed that the most consistent scoring person over the long run is the better player.
Thank you.
Thank you. We now know that is
now
true.
We know. I finally admit it. Roger is better than me.
Well, back then. Well, now
we don't
now
know.
We're both old.
We're old.
But I think the key ingredient was, and again, I go back to it. I mean, Ken Lunsford won a Nissan, a 280Z. I mean, he walked away with over $12,000 in prizes. It was like a Pioneer home video thing. I mean, there was Pioneer equipment. There was Yamaha stuff. I mean, there were jeans. I mean, all these various, in quotes, corporate sponsors. This guy walked away with, you know, a heck of a lot of stuff, more so than most people are even winning today when you think back. I don't remember anybody ever winning a car for a pinball tournament. But it was of that stature, and I go back to the fact that one shot. I mean, for those who know 8-ball, you know what I'm talking about. All right? Guy had finished it off. Okay, fine. Got the one shot. So, one game. And it was like, no, that can't be. And the whole premise for everything with this was the belief, and I know that Steve shared it, maybe we can do leagues.
And now this, to put it into perspective, Roger's background, his father was in retail clothing, and he brought to me a sense of my business as a retail business. You know, an amusement arcade, generally you don't think of as a retail business, but in reality it is. I'm selling a product. What I'm selling is time. You're paying for time, for entertainment. And I need to, as Roger impressed with into me, that I needed to create a value of that time. Now, the lucky break for me was when they did pass the law allowing pinball back into New York City, you could not give away replays. That was considered gambling. But you could have add-a-ball. So all my equipment was on add-a-ball, which lends itself to scoring more points rather than, you know, getting a replay. So the idea of encouraging people for the reward of a higher score versus that original, hearing that knocker go off, as Steve Ritchie often says, it did a very special thing, was very important. And this lended to it perfectly. So that's where the idea of leagues came in. These shirts were basically high scores. I'd spend, every 4 months, I'd spend a couple of $100 to $1,000 on shirts.
And various colors as well.
Various colors.
I showed Steve, I still have my lavender one and my gray one and my white one.
And the point was, I mean, you'd talk to operators and they'd look at you and go, why are you spending money on giving away something? I said, well, every time someone won a $4 shirt, they usually spend $10. So I didn't see the problem in that. Plus, they also advertised my business. It was walking billboards all over New York, which is also very, you know. So it was a win-win for everyone. And this basically came from the idea of retail.
And the nice thing, truthfully, is that I had a partner in crime. I mean, I could not ask for a better friend and a better soulmate when it comes to pinball, who had the same kind of love and passion for it, and more importantly, had a location that I could kind of work my dreams around and know that here was somebody who was willing to allow me to work those dreams through.
It was kismet. What can I tell you?
Really.
It's, when you think about the earth and all the things that could happen and how you just take two personalities to meet in one place to create these things was just, you know, it's astounding to me.
Well, and I knew the owners and operators of the other arcades that were down the block from Steve. I mean, they were decent guys, but there was no way in hell that I was going to do anything with them. And with Steve, really, it was a kindred soul. And I tend to be a person that kind of makes up things. So I mentioned before about PEBGA. And it was like, we got to create an association, an organization. So I came up, and this was my way. Lionel was not the best player in the world. It got very intense over a period of time. As Steve said, I mean, literally, it was 10,000. It was probably even more games than that. And Lionel tended to get lots of ones while we kind of distributed the fives and the tens together. So I said, well, we're going to create this association, this organization, and it's Mez International. Huh? Well, Martinez, Epstein, and Sharp. I don't have vanity. I'll go last. It's okay. I don't think that SEM really works, and EMS doesn't work. So it's Martinez, Epstein, and Sharp. So we'll do that. And I wanted a friendly name. I mean, if you think of the PGA, if you think of the BPAA, Bowling Proprietors Association, the Professional Golf Association. And I was like, how about the Professional and Amateur Pinball Association? That's Papa. And Papa was created in our own minds, in our own heads, and whatever else. And the key ingredient was, and I know that Steve believed this fundamentally as well, and understand, I have somebody who's on the firing line. And for anybody who's a location owner or an operator, I cannot stress upon you the importance of what I'm about to say. But he understood if he could offer that value added, if he could offer that stickiness, he would not only maintain his current clientele, he could grow it. And one of the things we talked about was leagues. Bowling does it. You know, what's a bowling alley? A bowling alley basically rents out space on the evenings to groups of people who come in to give the bowling alley X amount of money. They keep more money on the side so that they have a pool of stuff. And suddenly, if you want to go in for open bowling on a Thursday night at 8 o'clock, sorry, we're totally filled. Now, you can go there on an 8 o'clock in August, and maybe it's red pin bowling or some special thing, but they make their livelihood on leagues. And I had this dream, and maybe we've talked about it. I had this dream of maybe one day, and I remember talking to Ross Shear, who was the vice president at Bally, of walking into a bowling alley, in quotes it wouldn't be, it would be a pinball alley, and you would have 32 of the exact same games. That was one of my things. In lieu of that, because that wasn't practical or realistic, and not assuming that you could really get enough people to maintain those kinds of operations on a daily basis, it was like, all right, let's try leagues. And Steve, because he had the ability to do so, and I didn't, started, and I want him to fill you in right on how he did the first league as a sign-up. And truly, for anybody, how many of you are operators? Anybody here? Okay. Well, hopefully Steve can give you a little bit of clues as to how he got some of his regulars and irregulars to join forces in leagues.
We wanted to see first, at least.
There was a trial run.
Right,
yes.
Trial run. The trial league, the first league. I went around. We figured the league should consist of 9 people. That's really breaking 3 groups into 3. We're going to play 8 games a night or during a league period. And my thoughts were I'm going to get young men, and I'm going to do it at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning after partying on Friday night. If I can get 10-week commitment out of 9 young men to come in on a Saturday morning to play pinball in a league, we got a home run. And that's what I did. And 10 weeks later, we finished the first league, and it convinced me that we had a winner. So being the merchandiser that Roger created in me, I realized, and we both actually talking, that now we could use different types of groups of people. We had a women's league, we had a junior league, we could do charity leagues. I developed a parent and child league for the Big Brothers and Big Sisters of New York, and we ran team leagues with that. I mean, this was great for them because they, you know, when you're, I don't know if you, I was a big brother in college, so I realized that, you know, when I was doing that, I always was thinking, what am I going to do with my little brother? You know, there's always, you know, and this was great. This gave them a 3-hour Saturday morning or whenever I wanted to do it. It had to be on a weekend, obviously. So here your busy times are at night. Weekends, they're really not in the morning. So here I'm filling up time when no one's really in the arcade in any serious way, with 12, 18 people that are playing in a league that are, you know, having fun, putting money in the machines, and, creating an income stream.
Now, the big thing was that, and again, I mean, obviously I had some relationships with the companies, was fairly close doing projects, game design and other things as well, and just talking to them about this, even talking to Jules Millman, who headed up Aladdin's Castles, and just said, you know, and this is like the height of pinball. I mean, for that short comet life of when my book was published in 77 until around 79, 80, there was this burst. I mean, video didn't really happen, and then somebody punctured this balloon and the air went out, and you wound up seeing games like Orbiter 1 and other things, and people didn't really have a clue. But I'm just saying, there was this like surge in popularity. Like, how do you take advantage of it? Bally had made the appearance that Super Shooter was going to be an annual thing. Well, obviously, for anybody who follows history, there was only one. Never came back the second year. I really thought that if there could be sustainability for pinball, that leagues would be it, but there had to be a reward. And that's when Steve and I talked about staging a PAPA tournament, the first one, as a payoff for people who were playing in the leagues, as well as a way to bring in more people. So and first PAPA was what year, dear?
91. One for United Cerebral Palsy.
Right. 88.
And then we didn't do another. And then we did major ones after that. But
first one was at the arcade.
First one was
with Jelly.
No, that was actually at the Sheridan. Oh, and then we had the finals at the Lone Star Cafe. No, that was the second year, right?
Yeah, that was the second one.
Well, we can get old.
But anyway, I mean, the premise was that if he could take the people that now he had, because the feedback that I got was, and Steve mentioned before, and this is really an important thing to point out, New York City was at a ball. The types of earnings that Steve was doing on games, and look, I mean, the first sharpshooter that I designed went to New York City. Well, I can't say that. Test piece that I was able to get out of Chicago went to New York City. I wanted it at the Broadway Arcade. And when we were doing flash numbers, because that was the thing that everybody looked at. I mean, Steve was doing $600, $700, $800 a week on a pinball machine. How is that possible? The quarter play. Well, he wasn't giving away replays. He wasn't giving away 25% to 30% of his revenue.
And no match.
He wasn't giving 10% more on match. He wasn't giving away 40% of whatever that earning power was. And I think that when I found myself talking to people about this whole concept of leagues, PAPA, PEBGA, and all this other crap in terms of scoring systems and really having it be something fundamentally smart and capable of doing, I was met with, yeah, but that's Steve. That's your friend. That's the Broadway Arcade. So what did Steve and I do? There was a guy that I had befriended when I was working on my book in New Jersey by the name of Ron Colucci. Ron Colucci had a location called
Game Town.
And he had just moved his location to an old church. And I approached Ron, talked to Steve to make sure it was okay, and it was like, can we run a league here? Huh? I don't have time. I can't do it. Do it Sunday mornings. Just need to do a sign-up sheet. I will drive. By then, I was living in Connecticut. I will drive down from Connecticut every Sunday morning. I talked Steve into driving up from where he was in New Jersey to oversee this thing, and we had a league started at Game Town that sustained itself over that summer or winter, whenever it was, with people who were somewhat regulars and not regulars. And Ronnie even started showing up a few times and bringing them coffee, brought some rolls and things. It was like, nice, thank you, you got up. You're awake for this. And there was an earnings spike in his pinball machines. And I was like, this is proof positive. Here's this location that was just a standard location. He was getting beaten up badly down the road in Wayne, New Jersey, which was a neighboring town, by an Aladdin's Castle that was in a mall. They got all the new equipment. Let's face it, Aladdin's Castle was a part of Bally. So in some ways, he didn't have anything to lose. The problem that we had, and I saw it because Steve was unique, was that Ronnie couldn't maintain it. Didn't have the ability to maintain it. The players were willing to do it, but things kind of fell apart. But the entire premise of being able to create an environment where you can bring in players to play, that was the part that was truly critical as a proving point. And I think truthfully, and I take my hat off to Steve, to Frank Sininski, a name that you may or may not know in terms of the support that he gave Steve, to Betson, major distributor in the world of coin-operated amusement games, for lending their support, and for Steve being as insane as he was to follow the dream. We had Ben and Jerry's. We had Subway coming in as sponsors. I mean, there was major to-do, major media. I mean, when you see clips of Lyman Sheets playing pinball out in the freezing cold on CBS News Monday morning after he's won the world championship Sunday, it's things like that. And I think that, you know, what we wanted to show and prove was that you can stage something that is larger than life. And Steve, to his credit, picked what is a terrible time for weather in New York City, but is absolutely the right time. Steve identified, and rightfully so, that the best time to stage, in quotes, a sporting event, February. It's after the Super Bowl. It's before baseball really hits up. Basketball hasn't really gone on. I mean, if you look at all the sports and wound up designating the beginning of February to stage the Papa events.
We call talk about those slow news weeks. That's what we called it. And to you know our credit, we worked hard at it. We started to understand that one. I had a natural for some reason you know attraction to the media. I mean, I mainly because I was pretty much a block and a half away from every major, you know. ABC, NBC, and CBS were all within two blocks away. A lot of the correspondents and people actually were customers of mine. And, you know, so the idea wasn't to self-promote Roger and myself. The dream was to somehow create these images of pinball and competitive pinball that would sustain the industry, that would create a new demand for pinball. Because, you know, pinball was going up and down, video was here, everyone was freaking out that, you know, video is the only thing, pinball is the second stepchild. And in reality, it was, but it really wasn't. I mean, in this arcade here, I went from 8,000 square feet. This was actually a restaurant that was next door. After the hotel was built on top of us, Novotel, this was vacant. We were running out of a 30-year lease. We're on the last 8 years of a lease in the larger space. The landlord basically said to us, there was a buyout, and he said, listen, I want you guys out. I'm going to renew your lease. No, I'll renew your lease, but I think the rent went from $100,000 to $1 million. It was just impossible. He didn't want us there. But luckily for me, I had a customer. And it seems that's very strange because all these customers that I have all had really important things to say. He happened to be on the community planning board. And he told me that the hotel could not open because part of my space had to be used for the Novotel's lobby. They changed up the zoning on them. And if I stayed in that space, they couldn't open the hotel. So hence a huge lawsuit had prevailed, and you know, as in negotiating, it got down to the wire. The landlord basically said, well, I'll tell you what, you can have the space next door, which was actually very illegal because in New York City, your license was tied to your address. So to move physically 15 feet down was not legal. But somehow, you know, between the different powers that be, it got arranged.
Politics is wonderful, isn't it?
Politics is wonderful. So we went from the 8,000 square foot arcade to a 1,400 square foot restaurant, which we put in 64 games. I went from basically went from about 250 games to 64 games.
Now think about that for a minute. 1,400 square feet, 64 games.
And of those 64 games, 18 were pinball machines. Now this is an era of video where no one is operating pinball.
What year?
And this is 1986.
Yep.
And we had started the leagues in 84. And if you right above where these people are playing actually is this huge it was just part of what the restaurant was. It was a blank space, which when we did the leagues, we also said, well, we need to show recognition. So we created banners. I don't know if you could see them. But every league that we operated had its own banner with spaces for at least 20, you know, league sessions. And so everyone, you know, there you are. You're up there in the wall of fame. And that also reinforced, you know, what we were doing.
Now, the big thing, though, getting back to the Papa tournaments, by 1988, I was already working at Williams. Steve had really been doing everything kind of on his own. My thing, obviously, was we need to send out, and for those who were here for Larry DeMar's talk earlier, that short little thing that there were a few of us sitting over there, I got Tom Cahill to come out. We needed technical support. By then, we were both Williams and Bally. So, Williams and Bally, okay, well, I know that I'm going to get Gottlieb. So I called Premier and said, you know, you guys are testing there as well. We're going to do a tournament. I want the new games and everything else because we are going to create this thing that's going to be incredible. We're raising money for charity. We have these, in quotes, sponsors, if you will. I mean, the guy had set up a cart from Subway, corporate, that I had reached out to. I think it was through Steve or through Frank where we got Ben and Jerry's, or maybe that was even, I don't even remember.
No,
emails from Joe.
Okay. So, and we got, Steve was great, where we got a PR company to kind of help out,
right,
so that we had the coverage. I mean, at one point in time, the cast from Tommy was there with Brooke Shields, Lou Reed. I mean, it became like a real, real event. Yeah, but the bigger issue was to make sure that the industry supported, understood, and acknowledged what Papa was all about back during that time frame. And we're talking, obviously, pre the surge of 1991, 92, around Adam's Family, Twilight Zone, whatever else. This is leading up to it now. How do we sustain that energy? How do we do those things? And that was, you know, that was one of the turning points. Go ahead, please.
What, yeah, we have two discs, and I don't know if we can run them while we're talking, but, you know, that might work. And what they are, well, the first part of it is probably a promotion video that I set up because we were having some legal issues at the time, and we wanted to create a Save the Arcade, you know, type of thing. So maybe a little lower. So what you're going to probably be seeing is, and I don't know if anyone has seen the movie Special When Lit yet, but a lot of some of that footage is from these different pieces. And some of them is about a testimonial from different customers about what the arcade is. And then it'll blend into the different media coverage that we got over the years, over the five years that we did the Papa tournaments. And this is our sign that we had in the new arcade. That was the one we created. There's Roger playing. You can tell by, you know, the ring and you know the tie. But the whole idea, again, was to create, and that's why I hired a public relations company. That's why I spent, actually, money. It wasn't a, there's a young man there playing pinball. The song you're hearing is by Lou Reed. He actually wrote a song about me in the arcade. It's on an album called My New Joystick. That's a Joshua Sharp. Yeah, Mr. Sharp. And there's Zach. So now you have a kind of an idea.
A champion even then.
And it is amazing that Roger's two sons have really picked them. That's Joe Schick. He was one of the people that was instrumental in developing a lot of the promotions and a lot of the... he was the MC of all the tournaments, and he also had a lot to do with the publicity in writing. He's a great writer, actually, and... we met him playing pinball as well. Poor Zach. That's Josh? I think it's Zach. It's kids. Anyway.
Zachary's not here. We'll say that it's Zachary, but we all know who it really is.
Anyway, but the whole idea, and I don't know if anyone's familiar, but we not only did we accomplish getting a lot of video on television all around the world. We had incredible press from from magazines. Well, this is basically the arcade. This is the promotional video.
I started out really back in the days of Bagatelle.
Sharpshooter in the background.
Pickwick Papers with Dickens was really the first mention of it. Bagatelle was a form really almost like a pool.
I don't know who that guy is.
Play field. Out with balls scattered all around, and there was a picture in the Pickwick Papers of
this is actually the compilation of this
time.
Is going to run
what
for
America,
probably almost an hour and a half. So I mean, we're just
really
going to run it, not just this particular piece, but all the press coverages. And it's pretty exciting actually to see some of the stuff that we were able to create. But we had major articles in the New York Times. We had major articles in different magazines. And
just talk over me.
Well, you want to hear the same thing he always talks about?
Was a marvelous man. Harry. Dear friend who passed away a couple of years ago.
But to be, you know, this whole thing.
By the way, that is Harry Williams, for those who don't know.
Who I got to meet because of Roger. And it was probably one of the most exciting things that I really ever experienced was with Harry at my first trade show and being dragged around when I'm 24 years old by an 80-plus guy, and I couldn't keep up with him. because he was just so excited to show us all the new stuff that was around. I mean, he is. I mean, it just was extraordinary.
I mean, taking nothing away from the Harvey Heises of the world and Steve Kordak. I mean, these men that I really know and love. Harry was really unique. And you have to really have an appreciation of what he achieved and accomplished in this industry. And unfortunately, he didn't live long enough to really kind of be a part of Pinball Expo and to get the kind of accolades and acknowledgement that he really, truly deserved.
We're getting into the...
I know, but not long enough. That's what I'm saying.
It's interesting. I'm just as a side note, if you want to, you know, we'll go through this, but... you know, having being in this industry is great on one level, but to be exposed to what I was exposed to because of Roger's friendship and introducing to me to all the major players in Chicago and in the pinball world, and to allowing me to do all the types of things that I was able to do with the testing and really being on the front line of input into games that, you know, on the prototypes, which are, you know, if you're collecting prototypes, you know what kind of horror they are, and trusting us with the ability to give them feedback that would help them, you know, in the future was also very, you know, very, very
so I'm
good.
I'm going to transition now for a second because I think it's important. What wound up happening was that Steve's success was really unique. I had mentioned to Gary earlier that back in the early 70s, before I was involved or whatever else in any of this stuff, you know, still in, well, maybe not in school, but anyway. There was a gal by the name of Millie McCarthy who was out of upstate New York, and she had been running tournaments for a number of years. But it was just basically on more or less of a local level. That was the only stuff that had happened until Papa. It's kind of like, you know, when I got started, the only piece that had ever run, there had never been any books on pinball machines. Excuse me, there was a short feature done in Esquire magazine in 1972. So, I mean, I'm not suggesting that either internationally or domestically there might not have been other tournaments. The only one that was really acknowledged, if you will, by the industry was Millie McCarthy. And that kind of, like, faded away. Papa comes, and what's interesting is, and you have to understand the coin-operated amusement game industry, and for those who've been to the show long enough, you've heard from the Gary Sterns of the world, and you've heard from Pat Lawler about we're building something that's a commercial operation, making money, and all the rest of it. And that's all well and good. There's a whole political side to the coin-op industry. And that political side said that there were operators, and specifically operators and distributors in the Midwest, who were running dart and pool leagues. And that was the way of maintaining their locations. So they would lock up that bar, that tavern, that location because they were under a contract to be part of the NDA, National Dart Association, or the VNEA, which is for pool tables. So what winds up happening, that is the Novotel.
That's the hotel that got built on top of us.
So what winds up happening is we have Papa thriving. The industry has supported it with equipment, with people coming out, not really funding it. And because of distributors and operators being what they are, we wind up starting an organization called, because I named it, and the reason I named it is because the word flipper had to be in there for international reasons, and what was created was called the International Flipper Pinball Association. There was a meeting in downtown Chicago. The major manufacturers were all there along with the AAMA Board of Directors for the industry, and it was like, all right, we need to create another device, if you will, in order to maintain our places. We know that pinball leagues work. We know that tournaments work because Steve is now a living, breathing example of it. They've seen the media that we've been able to generate and some of the craziness that's going on behind me. So what winds up happening in that meeting is that they want to create a pinball association. Let's use Papa. It already exists. It's already established. It's been going strong for 5 or 6 years. We've worked with the March of Dimes. We've worked with Big Brothers and Big Sisters. And we've worked with the Sunshine Club. I mean, we have raised money for charity. We have gotten celebrities. We've gotten major media. And for anybody that's ever gone, and I'll mention it in a little while, the IFPA website, go back and look at the archives. I mean, the footage is incredible when you really think about what it was that we were doing without really any financial support from the manufacturers. So what wound up happening in that meeting was, number one, the creation of IFPA. Number two, my thing was, let's have Steve Epstein run it. Let him be president. Unfortunately, and I guess I can say this now, screw it, because there's nobody around anymore. I'm at WMS Gaming, the hell with it. Wally Borer was a very powerful person out of the state of Wisconsin. He had a son-in-law that needed work.
Matthew Broderick, by the way, who's yep. who's chatting about the arcade. He was the customer. He was up at the street in Biloxi Blues at the time.
So Doug Young right. needs work, and there was a guy by the name of Pat Conway who was heading up the NDA, so they set up this triumphant of people that were going to stage the first IFPA tournament, and they were going to try to incorporate leagues in the bars in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and let's see if it works, and it did. We paid in $100,000 as an industry to fund the IFPA. $20,000 by the industry association, $20,000 by Premier, $20,000 by Data East, $40,000 by us as Williams and Bally. And the first pinball tournament was an utter disaster because, as Dick Hawkins, a guy who was a distributor, discovered when they wouldn't listen to me, no extra balls, please. Well, tournament started, and we did a marathon today that started at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock or whatever and ran until whenever. Dick Hawkins made the epiphany somewhere in the middle of the first round that, well, so the better these players are, the longer it takes. Yeah, well, in darts, the better that they are, they play quicker. Well, hello, that's darts, you lunatic. We had a manufacturer's division, and Tom Cahill was one of my partners. I started with Ed Boone, for those who know Ed, either as Rudy or Mortal Kombat. Ed had to leave at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We started at 8. It was best 3 out of 5 games per games. We're talking about games of the era of Hoops, Funhouse, Checkpoint, and I'm playing against Gil Pollack. Huh?
Operation Thunder.
No, not there. It was Hoops. Hoops was the Gottlieb game. Harley Davidson was the Bally game. I mean, I remember the games because it was a nightmare. Literally, seriously, and I'll give you a couple of little high points, but started at 8 o'clock in the morning. This is the manufacturer's doubles division that was going on with the singles division. From 8 o'clock in the morning, without any breaks, we finished at midnight playing nonstop pinball. I burned through Ed Boone, George Petro, played with me for 2 hours, and then Tom Cahill, because he had to be there for technical stuff, also teamed up with me. The key ingredient was that nobody was willing to go outside the sphere of stuff. And the reason I'm talking about this is part of what we promised in the opening on this discussion was the restaging of the IFPA. Steve wound up working on an arrangement with Kevin Martin, and we can get into detail or not, and if there's Q&A, we can get into it that way, where Papa is now part of what Pinburg was, and Pinburg is now Papa. Well, my son, in his infinite wisdom, wanted to create something based off of what we had started and figured that if he could get these two old farts to kind of validate it, maybe there would be some support from the industry, whatever that industry was, which basically was Gary Stern. And maybe some legitimacy out in the outside world as well. And was it 3 years ago now, four? 4 years ago, we sat down at the spring trade show in Las Vegas with Joshua saying, hey, talk to these people, tell them what we want to do, talk to the distributors and whatever else. More importantly, for me to reach out to the industry association to find out, you guys really aren't using IFPA anymore. Can we get it back? And the reason for it was a frustration level that Kevin Martin wasn't doing anything. He was running an event. There was no major media. there was really no help to the pinball community. There was no incentive for anybody to feed in players. That was the whole purpose. I mean, there were times with Papa from the leagues where if you won in that league, you get an entry. You're there. I mean, you're going to be competing in the champions division. I mean, we had multiple divisions. It was incredible. There were doubles. There was an A division. There was a B division. There was a C division. There was children. There was women. There were doubles. I mean, there was all of these things going on to try to accommodate almost anybody and everybody. And I still remember when we had it at the Omni Hotel in New York City in Manhattan, because there was media. People knew about it. And I still remember there was one guy that walked in just to see the stuff. We had all the games lined up in this huge ballroom. What's going on? There's a tournament. Come on, play. Well, I'm on my lunch hour. That's okay. Come on and play. Just come on and play. It's a wall of games, which was the setup. You got to play from right to left. Just play 8 games and then come back later. I mean, it was bringing people off the street, people that kind of were exposed. You're playing like the C division. Not a problem. Come on. It's for beginners. Have some fun. It's $100 or $1,000, whatever the money that Steve was paying out of his own pocket to fund all of this stuff, because he was insane, thankfully. Because it was a money-losing proposition, but he believed strongly enough that he was willing to put out of his pocket. I felt bad because we had just dumped $100,000 that could have gone for what we were doing, and it would have been larger than life, and it would have sustained things. I truly believe that the future of pinball was adversely affected by the fact that the IFPA chose not to have Steve Epstein come in. Why? Because he wasn't somebody's son-in-law that needed a job. And it was somebody that they knew had too many qualifications and too many skills, and that we could build a player base. Now you jump forward a number of years, and I have two strangely perverse sons who have this love affair with pinball. I don't know where they got it from, who said that we can do something wonderful and incredible. We can create this community. See, the problem with the original IFPA was that we tried top down. It was the manufacturers in the industry trying to force the issue on location owners and operators and distributors. The players were a factor, but not really. We weren't reaching out directly to the players. Whatever Gary is trying to do with Jody's help and everything else, with websites and everything else, I mean, that's wonderful. And that technology exists now. But you got to be there at the street. You got to grab people, hold on to them. You got to go to the operator and the location owner the way that I did with Steve, and you have to make friends, and you have to do it sincerely. I mean, I had no vested interest in it. When Steve's revenues were going out into the stratosphere, it wasn't like I was on a payroll or anything. He was the unbeneficiary, and what was the premise? I didn't want to travel out anywhere. So he was getting new equipment from everybody. He was generating information that was critical for the designers of both video games and pinball machines. He was involved in promotions with all the major manufacturers. I remember Sega launching their Star Trek game or Star Wars game at Steve's location because he had everybody right there close to him, as he said. So in terms of what Joshua and Zachary wanted to do, it was like, wow, there is this community. We can create something with the IFPA. We have a structure in place for the scoring system, which was ours that we created. It's proven. There are leagues that are going on, and Josh showed that when he started a league at the University of Illinois where there had never been one before, and 12 years later, it's still running strong. The leagues that still exist on the East Coast, which Steve is now participating in, the leagues that have popped up and populated, why? Because IFPA is now offering an incentive. That incentive is Whopper points, World Pinball Player Rankings. What a marvelous idea. I'm going to play, and I am now one of 9,000, and it's growing. 18 country directors internationally, 17, something like that, 220 events taking place worldwide. I mean, the fact that there is this community and everybody can be on an even plane, if you're not Keith Elwin or Jorian or Josh or whoever else, you're still ranked somewhere. You're getting that acknowledgement. And there is that incentive with the IFPA tournaments or the Masters tournaments and all the other events that are taking place, that all we have tried to do from day one goes back to Joe Grillo and Ken Lunsford. The wrong person won a tournament. How do we rectify that, and how do we build up an awareness, an appreciation, and a sustainability for pinball in a competitive environment where everybody has the chance to compete.
Roger, can we ask, how many people in the room actually have Whopper points, have competed in a Whopper event?
What a surprise.
I like it.
Okay, so I think...
How many are part of a league currently? Good for you guys.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Right.
Pretty much everyone in the room.
How many remember back to the original Papas?
That really is great.
We pretty much, you know, did the whole arc here. More than happy to open up for conversation, questions, answers. We could run this, keep them running this, because eventually
can for yeah, some new video.
Next year, well, maybe next year, but you know, after this, there'll be a lot of clips from the Papa stuff. You know, if you want to hear some of the insides and the struggles that we had, we can go through some of that.
Yes.
We've got about 2 minutes for questions.
Sure.
So, yeah. One of the most vital questions, I think, right now is that there's enduring leagues like the Free State Pinball Association that basically have to pressure the locations from below. They assume that the locations are going to be hostile to the league, and they have to search out a location that's good enough, that's good enough maintenance, good enough operator, etc. Is that part of the future of pinball leagues? Is that going to be a necessary thing if it's going to be in street location?
Absolutely. I think what you have to do is you have to go en masse. You know, I had a unique situation here. I wanted to prove that the Papa scoring system worked and whatever else, and Diversions was an arcade. It was one of our test locations. Larry DeMar was in it, Brian Eddy. For those who play pinball, follow the rankings or anything else, there was this young child by the name of Jason Woodrick and his friend Eddie, who are video game players, and they saw us on a Tuesday night. What are you guys doing? Well, we're playing in a league. You play pinball? No? Come on and play. I mean, let me bring in another lunatic and see if I can, you know, get them hooked on this. And I think that the whole idea of going into a location and saying, look, we'd like to come in on a slow night, morning, whatever the time frame is, we want to spend lots of money here. If it's a restaurant or a bar, we're going to drink, we're going to eat, and we're going to play these games. We'd like to have the games maintained. We're willing to do it for you. I mean, the whole idea is how much are you willing to do and give? The example that I use, and it is a living example, and I had a long conversation, I forget with whoever, earlier today, and I hope that the analogy will work, and I'll try to be short. Sorry, Gary. I lived in a small town in Connecticut called Cheshire, Connecticut for a few years. There was a summer bowling league, and it was duck pin bowling, and it's a smaller ball, smaller pin, whatever. And the owner of that bowling alley asked if I would oversee, because she couldn't, the children's summer league. And I said, sure, what do you have for stuff for them? And she gave me some of the patches and whatever else. And I said, no, what else do you have? I physically went around to the local McDonald's saying, do you have coupons? We had like one nice restaurant in the town. Got them. Carvel ice cream. I went to the record store and got them to do a gift certificate. The clothing store to do a gift certificate. We had a small town paper. Hi, I'm going to be heading up the Children's Summer Bowling League. Will you print stuff on it about it? If you can get it to me Sunday night, we go to press Monday morning and it's out Tuesday. Fine. The league was Sunday afternoon. I would go home and I would make certain, and I gave awards. Here's a person who had the high game for the night. Here's a person that had, it was a good game. I wanted everybody to walk away with something each and every week for those 8 weeks. I went home. I typed up a story mentioning names, thanking McDonald's, thanking Carvel, thanking all these things each and every time, and every Sunday night there was something right there underneath the door, and on Tuesday I got to read the story seeing all these children's names for 8 weeks. Now, there was nothing in it for me. I wanted to give back because the children deserved it. And I thought maybe for some of them, it might be the only time in their lives that they will ever get acknowledged. And I'm sure that their parents had a copy of the newspaper. It's underlined, it's framed or whatever else, saying that Johnny Smith bowled a 98. I mean, whatever it was. And what I'm saying and suggesting is, if you are willing to do that on an individual basis, you know, if the location says, I really don't care, well, go to the surrounding businesses and say, look, if we're going to have a league, if we're going to do something, will you help support this? Go to the local newspaper and say, hi, if I get you something, will you print something? I mean, those are the things that we are ready. Steve and myself, we've done it. We have lived it for now 30 years. Josh and Zach have lived it and have proven that it really works. And if you take a look at the media that we've been able to generate, you know, proof positive that we have some innate talent and ability to make things happen, not only domestically but internationally. We are here within the IFPA to help, assist, offer guidance, direction. If necessary and it's convenient, we will be there. We will go there. Steve has gone to a number of places. I have. I know that Josh and Zach have. We will work hand in glove with you to make sure that you can make it happen and make it work. And that's even to the extent of not an existing league, not something that you're envisioning wanting to do, but how do I approach this location? Contact us. You know, I'm trying to meet with so-and-so, and we're having a difficult time. How do we do? Maybe it's somebody I know. Maybe it's somebody who works through a distributor or a sub-distributor where we can exert some pressure. I mean, Joshua with Melody Music or whatever the hell it was in downstate. You know, eventually there was some pressure to bear. So, you know, I may be out of the business, and Steve may be out of it, but the tentacles of who we know and the relationships that exist, and especially with Steve, Betson is the world's largest distributor. They have gobbled up everybody. Steve's closest and dearest friends are Betson. He has worked with them. He has worked for them. Frank Sininski and Joe Camerata, through Alpha Omega, have done incredible things on locations literally around the world. Close, personal, dear friends of Steve's. So if you want some of that help and assistance, all we're trying to say in this is that promoting pinball can work, getting locations to accept pinball, whether it's one machine or two, and that's the whole purpose. It doesn't have to be a new game. It can be an old game. It doesn't have to be two or ten machines. It can be one machine. Whatever it is, how do we populate the universe with more games, new or old? I don't care if it's a Stern game. I don't care if it's Canasta from some company in Spain. All of these things are doable and possible to help grow the marketplace, because guess what? At the end of the day, if we're all here for a singular purpose of wanting to see pinball survive and thrive, maybe there'll be a second company. Maybe there'll be a third. To assume that Gary is feeding the marketplace to the total extent that it can be fed isn't necessarily true. I believe that the marketplace can be bigger and stronger and more vital and vibrant. So,
well, you know, Gary, in his talk yesterday, it was very astounding to me, because he basically was saying, jump the operator, you know, go in on yourself. I mean, and offer the location to bring in people. And if they won't upgrade the equipment or bring in a pinball machine, maybe some of the, you can operate your own. I mean, that's an extraordinary leap from my day when, you know, this was a strict, you know, the manufacturer doesn't mess around.
If I go into a location, I'm promising them an extra $50 a week, an extra $100 a week. I mean, you have to factor those things in. It's the same thing that I do when I go in to have a bowling alley allow me to operate. We will promise you X number of dollars. There's going to be 12 players. At a 50 cents a game or whatever else, we're going to bring in X amount of revenue, not counting practices. However, the only thing that we're asking is that the games actually work. I mean, how do you want to do that? I did a nasty thing in Connecticut, and again, self-serving. There was a place called Crazy Eights in Waterbury, Connecticut. It was the only place around that actually had pinball. The pinball that they had, I remember one game, actually had, there was a thumper bumper. Well, it didn't exist. They had actually put tape on that part of the play field. The games were in garbage shape. There was a pinbot that played fair. And I remember talking to the store owner, manager, or whatever else. It wasn't his equipment. There was a guy that came once a week to clean the games. No, he didn't. He was coming once a week to collect. And I got really frustrated. I wound up meeting with the guy and said, no, I'll fix it. I'll clean it. And I wound up writing notes and whatever else. Well, what wound up happening, because I got frustrated, was I wrote a piece in Play Meter and Replay and Vending Times talking about Crazy Eights and how disastrous the place was, how terrible it was, and whatever else, to the point where I got a phone call. I also talked to the distributors in the area. I mean, it's not a question of making somebody angry at you. All I wanted, I didn't want new equipment. I loved new equipment. I just wanted stuff that was functional. And he wound up changing over his stuff. If it means going after the person through a distributor or through an operator and talking to somebody directly, because the people that you're dealing with, whether it's a store manager or whatever else, is not the person. If it is the location owner, that's not the person that's running the equipment necessarily. You have to get to that source. And again, how much of yourself do you want to invest in that? How important is it to you? For me, it's a lifeblood. I haven't gained squat from it other than the satisfaction of seeing, again, my sons carrying on a legacy that I never thought I would have, a friendship and a bond that I will treasure and value to my last dying breath. That's all that pinball has meant. All the rest of it and all the other stuff is all just the accoutrements. I mean, it's fine. But I believe strongly enough, and as I said, I'm not asking anybody to do anything that I either have not done myself or I'm not willing to do again. The question is, are you willing to get behind it and make it happen? And it's not to the benefit of Gary, because he's the only company left. It's to the benefit of having people be exposed to pinball in places other than the basement of your house. Yes?
I have a bowling alley. It's near my house. There's a lot of empty space there.
Yes?
And I sort of envision wanting to have storage for that. So I'm running out of space. So I'm thinking I could probably fit, I looked at any space and say how many machines I could fit. Right. I figured I could fit 20 machines along one wall. And I went to the manager the other night. You're doing nothing with this. Nothing. There are three police training video games. It never gets played because the cranes are staggered. Nobody does it. Let me put my pinball. He said, I think that's a great idea.
Okay.
Now talk to C.A. Robinson, AMF is a contact.
Right.
They won't let you do it.
Did you talk to Sandy Bettelman?
I didn't know who that is.
Sandy is the co-owner of C.A. Robinson. Dear friend, give me a call, send me an email, because what you want to do is actually rent out that space. You're going to be willing to give them $100 a month or whatever. But that's what I'm saying. But the whole idea is knowing who to talk to. I can just tell you off the top of my head. Well, thank you for being here, and we're here to help. I mean, my biggest frustration, and I will use a name. The guy's name is Steve Belmonte. He's an operator in New England. He won an IFPA tournament at an ASI tournament or an AMOA tournament. We talked at length, both Steve and I, for the 3 days. The guy was all psyched. He's operating pinball machines, would love to do stuff. Here, give me business cards and whatever else. Has done squat. And it just frustrates me.
Where is he based?
Somewhere outside of Boston or Mass, somewhere. I mean, I have a business card still. I have seen him at a trade show, and he apologized. I'm going to get to it. I'm going to get, yeah, right. You know, I mean, don't dick around with me. Do it to Raj Sharp, S-H-A-R-P at AOL. Sandy Bettelman and Ira is his brother.
His brother.
And their dad started C.A. Robinson. Good guys.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you have a contact with AMF?
Do I have a contact with AMF?
Yeah, AMF Bowling made a ruling about a year or two ago that they will no longer carry any pinball machines in their bowling alley.
And the reason for it being?
They are a mechanical nightmare, and they don't care if you're the best technician in the world and you're going to service them. We don't want them.
So my question is this. That's a corporate decision and policy.
Yep.
McDonald's never used to allow games in their places. There was a place in Connecticut or New England, I remember, I think it was Burger King. It was called Burger King Castle. This guy had this magnificent, I couldn't believe it. I actually did a birthday party for one of my sons there. It was a Burger King, and attached to it, you would walk through from the food area, and it was like an indoor, you know, Chuck E. Cheese type place. I guarantee you that if it's an AMF policy, I'm a franchisee of that particular AMF location. If you want to go back to the store manager or the bowling alley establishment manager and say, look, I would like to rent out the space, the equipment that's in there, the vending machines, the phone, and everything else, is not operated by him.
I know that. There's four different AMFs in my area. Four of them. All four, and they all will not let me bring pinball.
Are they all owned by the same person?
No. Four different individuals.
Is there one that's easier to work with than anybody else? One that's younger?
I had one, the girl.
Well, let me ask the question this way.
Okay.
I'm just trying to be devious and creative. Do they operate video games?
No.
Would they want to? Would they do a touch screen in the bar?
They probably have a touch screen and they have a dart machine and a...
Do they want a golf game? Something like a golden tee?
I got those too, but they just...
They don't want a golden tee.
Oh, they'll take a golden tee, sure.
Really? So they'll take one coin-operated amusement game from you and they're going to be doing halfway decent and then you can slide in a pinball machine in a couple of months after that.
Yeah, but they tell me right away, no pinballs. I don't understand. And the best thing is,
And the reason that they're giving is that, and I'm sorry if this, maybe we should take it offline, but I guess my only question is this. If it's the manager making the decision and the excuse that they're using is that it's corporate, then the question is, who do I contact at corporate? Yeah, give me a call. There's great resources. If you're old enough, there used to be a time where you could go to a library and there were publications called the Advertiser Red Book, and that would give you listings of the corporate personnel. I would go into the listing for AMF. I would look for the marketing promotional manager. I would try to contact that person and say, look, I would like to actually place some pinball machines in my area, in this bowling alley, because, and this is where you need to do some front work, I'm going to be working with the local fire department, PTA, police department, choose any of them, the local children's hospital, because I'm going to be donating, thank God, for somebody in Las Vegas who does these kinds of things. I'm going to be donating 10% or 20% of the cash box to support that charity and the fundraising thing for cancer awareness or whatever else. And let's see if AMF says yes or no, because then what I'm going to do for you, and all these people are witnesses, when they say no, there's going to be an incredible editorial that's going to be written by me that's going to be sent to the various local newspapers saying that AMF has turned down raising money for breast cancer awareness and the Susan Coleman Fund. They have turned down money to open up the children's ward and wing. What do we think about this? And if they won't put it in a newspaper, at least I'll put it on the website. We can blog it, we can Twitter it, we can do whatever we want, and we'll see what kind of pressure will be born. I mean, what I'm saying is, if you get frustrated enough and you have the energy enough and the capacity to think outside the box, you can almost force anybody do anything that you want because it's going to benefit them.
Yes. Kicking and screaming.
This is going to benefit that bowling alley, and once you get one, the others will follow.
Yeah.
I mean, what I'm saying takes work. Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that it's actually going to happen, but God, I would love to do it just for the fun of it. Just to tweak these four different owners and to see, and more importantly, tweak AMF. And worst case, if it's only AMF, let's talk to Brunswick, because maybe they're in the area. Okay, then it's AMF. Let's go for it.
Okay, and with that, I'd like to say, if you want to hear more and see more about these two great guys, they're starring in a movie due out somewhere between now and Christmas. I understand it's the DVDs are being put together as we speak. It's a movie called Special When Lit. The producers and film crew have been out to Expo and shot a lot of footage, so you'll see a lot of other people that you will bump into.
Yeah,
in
but
the
everybody
hall.
Dies.
And some
in
of
the
people
end.
In this room, I can see Coy at the back. He's certainly in there. But before I invite you to come up and shake hands with these two great pinball guys, I'd like you to show your appreciation the conventional way of putting your hands together, please.
Thank you.